welcome to Blockchain Gaming World, episode 109. I'm your host, John Jordan, and I'm very pleased that joining me today are Vincenzo and Dan from Core Loop. How's it going, guys?
Good.
Very well. Thank you. Thank you for having us tonight.
Good. So, Core Loop, you're making a game called World Eternal Online. I'm going to spend a bit of time talking about that, but before we do that, let's get a bit of background about you two guys. So, Vincenzo, do you want to go first? Tell us a little bit about your background in gaming and also a bit about how you ended up making a blockchain game.
Yeah, for sure. Thank you. So, my name is Vincenzo Lagna. I'm the CEO and co-founder for Core Loop Games. I've been in the game industry for around 20 years. My first like game was actually on Game Boy Color, which was coded a long time ago in assembly. That's when I did my first startup, and that's where my never-ending love for the game industry started, honestly. Most recently, like I think the last 10 years of my career have been focusing on mobile games and free-to-play, and I was like two companies which really helped us learn a lot. One was Gree, which is where I worked with Dan, first in London and then in San Francisco. And the second one was Machine Zone, which made a few big hit titles like Game of War, Mobile Strike, Final Fantasy. And also tremendous learning, like a lot of really good people there. And in 2019, after leaving that company, I was like wandering a little bit as a digital nomad around the world, talking with friends and trying to see the trends. That's you have the chance to do this once in a while. I think I was in Tokyo and it was like, hey, you know, I'm looking at trends and things that really was interesting for me. And there were a lot of projects that I really wanted to do that you never get to do, you know, at some point in your career, you want to start that. And it was all about transferring ownership back to players, how we can involve the community more, like in, you know, the products we are making. And it became obvious for us that MMOs and like the type of MMOs we were doing before was the right format. And so I started thinking about creating a new company and calling people around. And very few people are crazy enough to just say, yeah, no, that's a great idea. But one of the people actually picked up the phone call and decided that it would join with me was actually Dan. And I was super lucky about that. And we bonded together and say, you know, let's try to do this again. And that led us to 2020 when we raised our first seed round and started to create a company. So that's pretty much the journey so far. And then from 2020 until now, Dan and I, we have been building Core Loop Games and the projects you mentioned before, World Eternal Online.
Cool. Good. Dan, do you want to give us your journey up to and taking the phone call from Vincenzo?
Yeah. Similar, you know, I've been in games for 20 plus years. I started out making like a Xbox launch title. I started out as an engineer and doing a little bit of game design on the side. I even worked on, you know, a Tomb Raider game at, you know, Crystal Dynamics. So really a pretty, you know, odd path. But then eventually got into making Facebook games at Funzia, which turned into mobile games around like 2009 or 2010. So there at Funzia, we did a bunch of kind of like early mobile RPG games, call it Crime City, Modern War. And then we got bought by Gree. And there I designed this game called War of Nations, which was, you know, this 4X strategy MMO game. Obviously, you know, Game of War was a kind of similar game that was coming out also around the same time. And really, you know, I think Gree was largely responsible for, you know, like how we really learned to make, you know, great free-to-play mobile games at that point. And then after that, I did another startup called Mastermind Studios. We did a mobile game. That studio kind of went okay. Eventually did not go so okay at some point. You know, we couldn't survive the UA crunch, user acquisition, you know, costs at that time in like, what was that, like 2015 or so. And then I kind of wandered around, did some consulting here and there. I even made an early blockchain game with some ex-coworkers in 2017 called Crypto Assault. I couldn't get rid of that whole Forex strategy bug, so it was like a turn-based like MMO. I mean, if that makes sense. Not that everyone's like taking turns, but they kind of move their unit and then they have to wait a long time. And that was on the Ethereum blockchain back then. So yeah, and then here I am now with Vincenzo doing Core Loop.
I still have a few crypto assault tanks and helicopters. Actually, I went through a cycle of you guys launched it, then someone else picked it up after you. So I ended up sort of playing through there. It was definitely interesting. Killed by gas costs, like so many games on Ethereum.
Yeah.
Maybe we'll talk about that a bit. But I think one of the interesting things about kind of you two and Dan, our sort of paths crossed back in the day when you were at Gree. But you know, for people who were back in the free to play mobile, you know, days, you know, Gree and certainly MZ Machine Zone were some of these sort of seminal companies who built, you know, I guess who took free to play mobile gaming from beyond what were some fairly simple sort of at least sort of gameplay loops into these sort of very deep experiences with sort of a lot of alliance stuff going on there, and you know, that to me has got an interesting sort of hinterland for you guys to then be working on a blockchain game. But I'd like to sort of pick a little bit more into the blockchain thing, because you've basically said your sort of histories of working in games, and then very sort of simply said, well, we wanted to make another MMO, and here we are, you know, raised $14 million to make a blockchain version of an MMO. But can you talk a little bit about, you know, why, what blockchain does that you think is really useful, particularly for MMOs?
So the question was, you cut out just for a second there, like,
sorry. Why is blockchain important? I mean, particularly for MMOs, what's it bringing in the just the sort of conceptual sense, not in any sort of detail, but why do you think, you could raise money to make an MMO without using blockchain? So why are you doing it using a blockchain?
Yeah, that's true. I mean, for me, God, there's a lot of things kind of being thrown around, like, you know, the metaverse or whatever it is that blockchain does. I think for me, like, a big thing that we want to do is it's around, there's that whole kind of thought back in WoW and, you know, early MMOs where, like, people are wanting to sell their accounts, right? So they work to get their account up to, like, a high level hero, and then, you know, they no longer want to play or whatever that is, and they kind of want to, sell that off. So to me, that type of interaction, at maybe even a more granular level than just the account level, makes a lot of sense. So whether you want to, like, level up a hero and you're not interested in playing anymore, or like a profession or whatever that is, a piece of land, and then kind of, if you're no longer interested in playing, then you can sell that off to another player and they can, you know, benefit from that, and the world keeps on moving along. So to me, that was like kind of one of the largest things there.
Mm-hmm. Also, if I can add to that one, when we did the first interview, like, I think with Dean Takashi, like 2020, we were already talking about moving away from controlling many parts of the product and trying to move it towards the user experience. If you go back to the what you mentioned before, what we can get as a learning from the mobile and free-to-play was that those games were not, they were really deep in the meta level, where there was a lot of gameplay, a lot of, like, interaction and politics, very deep in the guilds, very deep on the interaction between players, right? And because the interface was not as aggressive, like, it wasn't graphically so captivating, right? But still, it was a lot of people were dragged into and spent a lot of money in those games, right? So there must have been something there. And a lot of these things were revolving around, who will control a kingdom? Who will control the land? Who will be the best and top players in the game, right? So there was a lot of things around the roles that people played in those products. And they will create their own fiction. They will create, like, you know, there is this guy with this nickname. When you come into the realm, everybody listens because you are the top player. You're the strongest player for different reasons. And so we wanted to say how much we can push it in moving control away from just us as designers, creating the systems, and see which part of the emerging behavior people create around it. And it was like, well, you know, in a normal RPG, probably you have a city which is controlled by AI, or NPCs. Why don't we give this to the player and let them control the city? That is the shops and everything that we do. Why don't we move this to the players and let them be the shopkeepers and whatnot? And so this was in 2020. And we were trying to figure out which one it was the best system to kind of share this ownership with players. And how would you go about part of governing this equation and part of giving them the ownership and an incentive to be part of this system? Simultaneously at that time, with some of the experience from them before, some of the things we've done before, like exploring blockchain, it looked like the market was really accepting that de facto the standard for this was blockchain, right? People were just talking about participation in guilds, a lot of shared ownership. So there was this kind of fortunate combination for us as we were also deciding like what was the layer that will allow us to really verify and really transport this ownership. This all the market was already deciding for us too. So we say, okay, you know what? This is the way to go. And we had some intense conversations about it, like back and forth with them many times. And then as a story about me pestering him every month, and he says this in every meeting, like every month was like, should we do this? And Dan was like, yeah, but now like, I need to find the formula. And then eventually, like one day Dan was like, okay, I'm going to spend a couple of nights, or I don't remember, it was one night or two nights, really thinking about it. And then the day after calls me and say, okay, I think I have a formula. Why don't we talk about this? And that really kicked off us in that direction, or think around. It was like maybe before the summer of 2021 or something, like when we started decided that would be the layer that we will utilize on top of all the other things we're building to share the ownership between people, players, and also with the studios themselves. And so this is a pretty good structure for us. And so that's really the foundation. Then the details of the implementation and everything comes around it, whether it is DAOs, foundations, tokens, non-tokens, NFTs, but that's really the substance.
Yeah. Go ahead, then.
Oh yeah, just to like add to that a little bit is, like early in my career, it was all about, I was always like a team member on these kind of single player, you know, story based games like Soul Reaver or, you know, Tomb Raider or something like that. And I always felt like the content was so wasteful, you know what I mean? Because like you run by a castle that someone spent, you know, months making and then that's gone. And then the gameplay also was very much, you know, someone who plays Tomb Raider largely has the same experience as someone else. You know what I mean? And for me, games have always been about like, how does it become like a unique experience for everyone? And that just like, that's why the MMO was like a perfect thing. And that's why, you know, the more we thought about how to insert other players into the progression with, you know, like these user-made cities in the game and like what those cities look like and what type of makeup they have, let the users figure that out, have the whole, you know, crafting economy be this more like free marketplace for the players themselves. And so like that just kind of led us down this path of, okay, you know, if we can start to control or, you know, like Vincenzo says, like give some of the control to the players of these types of licenses, like, oh, you know, we're only going to create this many blacksmith licenses or alchemist licenses, and you guys can make your own cities or whatever that is. That's kind of, I think was a lot of the motivation, like I looked a lot at like games like EVE Online, or I used to play this MMO called Albion Online quite a bit. And I just love those type of economies because they were so, you know, player driven. And I thought that blockchain and kind of licensing those players inside of that economy made a lot of sense.
Hmm. And I guess it is notable. I mean, on your website, the sort of first thing you see is it says World Eternal Online, a player-driven sandbox MMO. So you sort of have that sort of stamped on the, you know, on the across the door, I suppose.
Yeah.
That's the sort of the mission statement. And there was sort of going. I mean, it's also interesting. You put out your white paper fairly recently at the end of April, and you do spend a lot of time sort of discussing these sort of things, and we'll get into that in a bit more detail. But one of the other things I think that sort of stands out, certainly to me as someone looking at the project, is there's a tendency for a lot of these sort of heavy duty complex games to really spend much more time on tokenomics and what blockchain they're on and their NFT drops and when their tokens going live and the DeFi around it, and you have sort of, I assume, purposefully been very, very light on your sort of, you know, technical blockchain elements. At the moment, you've not got any NFTs or any token or anything like that live. You don't really talk about that. I mean, I guess you're, you know, to a degree, you're sort of well-funded already from traditional VCs. But, you know, has that been something you've been sort of careful about, or is that just something that's sort of come from you guys coming from a more traditional game background and you want to focus on the traditional game design stuff?
Yeah, I think there is a combination of both. I mean, we definitely spend a lot of time doing modeling and doing like mathematical modeling and all these other things that we're trying to really tie to the economy. But I think it was a conscious decision that we will try. As you mentioned before, there is a lot of projects, and I'm really interested in all the creative aspects of all these other things in there. Like the community building, the drops, all these other parts, it's really important. And there is a lot of sharing in the community. You can go read from other people, learn a lot. For us, it was, I think we need to build the game first. And we went through the cautious route of going and trying to convince people that see a lot of projects, right? The VCs in the first place, it's very hard to get there and to get attention and to talk to them. And so I guarantee that we can build the product based on our experience. And as we're building the product, and we are able to show and prove to the people how the utilization of the NFT and also tokens and whatever comes next in the future and will be inside the product, but that is really driven by something that can be played and tested. So that's why we're trying to rush through building the game, and then we'll show how the game is live and show by example really how this all things integrate. I think it's a more tangible experience if you want to on-ramp and you want to onboard new players inside the blockchain world, inside the Web3 world, and just like show them the product, bring them there, show the quality, and then improve from their layer. And that is really, I think that's the bet we have been making so far. Just go for the product first and then introduce the concepts as lightly as possible without overcomplicating. And so that is one of the things that we've been cautious about.
Okay, let's talk a little bit about actually then what's going on there. So you've basically, if I have understood it properly, you've basically got sort of three sort of core roles that are things that people, you know, roles that the players might, you know, take on. So you've got this, I guess, traditional adventurers, so that's sort of things we'd expect in a sort of combat-based MMO. And then you've got these crafters and these land barons. So can you talk a little bit about, describe, you know, a little bit about why you've got those three and how, you know, why you've chosen three and how those roles are sort of different and how that plays into this idea of sort of, you know, handing control to the players as much as possible?
Yeah, so, I mean, just to clear one thing up before we start is like, a player can kind of be all three of these roles. It's just easier to talk about them separately sometimes. But yeah, I do make that division like kind of mentally. So with heroes, the adventurers, right? Like they're your kind of, like you said, typical RPG player, right? You run around, you create guilds together, you go out and kill monsters, do dungeons, bosses, harvest resources, all that sort of good stuff, right? And all the while you're kind of leveling up your hero and progressing forward and making gear for yourself or drinking potions to prepare for all these battles, right? So a lot of typical MMO type of stuff. Then the second thing is kind of like these crafters that are inserted into the hero progression, right? So there's no way to make gear for yourself. You need to, normally in a game like, I don't know, World of Warcraft or something like that, when you kill a monster, they drop weapons and armor, right? But in some other types of MMOs, those monsters end up dropping materials or resources that you then use to craft stuff with, right? So here it's kind of the same case. You're killing monsters, you know, you're killing dragons, whatever, maybe they drop like purple dragon scales. You then take those materials to a blacksmith who is actually another player or an alchemist or a pet breeder, whatever it is. And you take these resources there and they kind of make something out of that for you, whether that's like a sword or another pet or some potions, right? So if you can, that's where I always think about it. Like, I mean, in the old days of taxis and taxi medallions, that's kind of how I think it was, like, okay, we're going to distribute some number of taxi medallions, or maybe the less like, the other type of analogy I like to make is like a liquor license inside of cities, right? There's only so many liquor licenses, and you can kind of give those out and sell those to people, and then they can become blacksmiths and alchemists and whatever in the world. And so, yeah, And the landowners kind of own the land that they then place their buildings on top of. And then I think it's important that, you know, while players are bringing them these resources to make things, there has to be a symbiotic relationship, right? It can't just be like a one-way relationship. So then guilds also place their guild halls or, you know, guild buildings inside of the city, and they benefit the crafters as well. So the guilds might get a discount on some of the crafting things, and they also might be able to increase the power of what the crafters make, while the guilds go out and but then the guilds can kind of go out and capture points and make the cities more powerful. They kill monsters. Every time they kill monsters, they can refill some of the supplies of the blacksmiths and alchemists and whatnot. So there's very much like this give and take relationship that's going on. So if it's beneficial for me to do, then it should be beneficial for you know, both sides to do, right? Because I feel like, you know, players are always selfish. So it's like you have to incentivize both sides. It can't just do it for the good of another person. But that's the design in a nutshell.
So how much harder does that make it at the beginning? Because at the beginning, I guess you have, you know, everyone sort of starts at whatever level zero, level one or something. And how do you have those sort of systems in place? How do you sort of gear them up to, you know, a year down the line, it's fine. But that sort of initial state where it's not really clear sort of who's who and how those systems are sort of bootstrapped up. Have you got thoughts around that?
Yeah. So the people who like initially purchase like a blacksmith building and place it down, then those blacksmiths start out with a default set of recipes or alchemists or whatever profession it is. I just keep on saying blacksmith because it's easier. But they all start out with a default set of recipes, right? And then, you know, that's going to be what sustains and kind of kickstarts everything. From that point on, you know, there can be like rare recipes or like a limited number of recipes which get dropped by the monsters. So then the heroes can be the ones finding those and then sell them to the blacksmiths, right? So I think it's really, really important to have the professions start to like specialize, right? So if I've purchased a lot of fire recipes off of hero players, right? So I can make like fire swords and fire armor and whatever that is. Then I might also want to upgrade my blacksmith down like the bonus fire, talent tree or whatever it is. So as I do that, I might need to buy dragon hearts because that's the way I upgrade my blacksmith towards the fire tree, right? So then all of a sudden, I'm the guy who makes the best fire recipes in the world. So when the ice monster comes out on Monday, you guys got to come to me to buy your fire sword, right? So there's really like a bifurcation of like talent and like, you know, specialization going on. And there's still room in the market for other people, right? So I can only make so many swords and fire swords per day, right? So someone might want to swoop in and kind of take my leftovers in the marketplace, right? So that kind of provides that control that I can't just like mark up my prices, you know, for forever, right? So there's all those types of like market controls that I think exist in the free market that you know, games like EVE Online have always done that I always found like super interesting.
Okay, so that's sort of a bit of the sort of conceptual stuff, the design side. Obviously, you know, you've mentioned that you kicked off the project in 2020, which is obviously a while ago now. I mean, it depends upon in 2020, I suppose. But sort of where are you at the moment in terms of sort of development and what's your roadmap for the rest of 2022 looking like?
Oh, yeah.
Vincenzo, you should be saying that, surely.
Yeah,
I won't tell you.
You know, I always wait a little there because Dan is always so passionate about it. So if I see the spark in the eye, sometimes I just let him go. But I think we are really excited about what we play the game internally. I think every Thursday. So we're just really like, you know, we're at that stage where we are refining and doing things with the team. And sometimes it's also funny because we set out to do a playtest for 10 minutes, and then 14 minutes later, an hour later, we're still playing. It's so good when you start to see other people in the map, you go and kill the monsters. You want to keep trying things and trying new skills that maybe your VFX artist built or the designer put together. You just, oh, look, all these other things. Oh, this other piece of the UI works now. Look. And so there is that part, which is super exciting to see. And we have made it as a rule, like, hey, let's get there as quickly as possible. Let's play the game internally. So with that said, we're really setting a probably really, really aggressive goal for us to be ready for at least the close alpha, let's say around July. Okay, and that's what we've been discussing a little bit around. And there is going to be some things, some other milestone in between, a couple more reveals, articles we're going to release to the public to explain a little bit more what we're building to ramp up to there. We're building the community as well in the meanwhile. There is like a lot of people. I think I don't remember exactly the number. Like I should check all the sources. But let's say it's a little less than probably 100,000, but like more than 50,000. I have to check all the numbers. The people pre-registered, and so we're starting to get to a place where we are. We're comfortable with the numbers. Probably not going to be able to onboard to everybody on the alpha, but like, you know, as many people that can come and help and find bugs and, you know, start to refine the gameplay. And so this is a very aggressive theme. When you listen this, like, you know, you know what we're doing there, like everybody knows. You know, we're such a great theme, and this has been a pleasure for us to work with everybody. So it's one of the rare experiences you get to probably do once every 20 years in your career. You get everything in the right place with the team. So yeah, that is really the milestone we are keeping the most in front of our calendars right now. Just like we have to get there, and yeah, there is going to be the rest of the updates and content releases along the way, just to keep building with people. There is like some whitelisting and other things that we're building with the community, which is fine to prepare for the first like sales. But you know, as we mentioned, we're not going to do this until we are ready with an alpha of the game at the very least.
Mm-hmm. But there's still from an MMO point of view, where these things can take sort of up to 5 years to sort of build. Yeah, it's still sort of seen as you know, you say aggressive fairly quick. So I mean, do you feel the sort of, maybe pressure is the wrong word, but do you feel that sort of, it's better to get sort of something out as early as you can and then sort of iterate, which is sort of seems to be what a lot of blockchain games do, rather than very much the traditional publishing route, maybe certainly 5 years ago, would be to, you know, we'll hold it all for as long as we can we'll have a set. It's going to be the 13th of July 2025 is when this game's coming out, sort of thing.
Yeah, I think in that sense, even though the game is going to be on PC and mobile, we come from more of a mobile development cycle background. So, you know, we like to release things early, even though they may not be in a totally polished state and maybe some, you know, features might be missing. I think as long as there's some set of things that the people can, you know, meaningfully play, you know, and maybe I'm sure like we'll have periods of, you know, resetting their progress and kind of testing it over, because it's going to be a very much like a alpha beta state at that point. So, it's very different from that kind of, you know, PC console thing where you really wait till the whole thing is finished, and that would probably take us much longer. But for us, it's like, you know, release in an early rough state, get a lot of feedback, and then, you know, I don't know if the game is ever done for us. We're always constantly adding new features, and that's very much the way we worked at GRI and Machine Zone as well.
Yeah, I remember somebody recently was asking us if we were planning DLCs and how frequently, and we're like, we don't know what it is. Like, you know, usually in free-to-play, you release new features weekly and new events and new content. So that really primed us for this process. So, yeah, I think it's an interesting shift in how you develop everything, from the technology to the way you're making your content and everything else. So, yeah, I can see that it's a little bit different approach. Yeah.
Mm. And I guess sort of to finish up, I'd be interested to get your opinions on this, as you know, you guys have obviously been looking at this space since sort of 2020. 2021, we saw the traditional games industry for the first time sort of wake up a little bit to blockchain, and obviously different opinions from different companies, but now it seems like, you know, most people are you know, trying to do something in the space. I mean, how do you see, you know, the sort of you know, the interaction of blockchain and gaming as a sector? Have you been sort of surprised at how fast it's gone or how slow it's gone, or, you know?
That's a good...
I think there are some elements of what we saw, I think, 2010, 2011, and 12, right, with mobile, where there were a lot of people. I mean, the numbers were starting to come out. The adoption was there. A lot of companies were interested. And everybody, what they did, they tried to do exactly the same product on PC or console and put it on mobile. Few of those products became big. If you look at the big names, like, they were not traditional developers, right? Supercell, MZ, and a bunch of others, they were not coming from that background because they tried an experiment with something new and trying to leverage the strength of the platform, right? The strength was like always connected, come quickly online, play in fractions or for long amount of times, a lot of chatting. So we're trying to understand what are, I think, the people you have to approach this now. It is the same thing. Like, people that try to put NFT in traditional games right away. You know, it's just like I'm trying to change the menu of the restaurant you went in. I came here for McDonald's. I'm presenting you, you know, pizza. Like, that's not what I wanted. Like, but you're changing the menu as I'm sitting already, right? So maybe that may not work right away. But I think if you are building the product from the foundation, trying to leverage the strength of the platform, you know, sharing, participation, the community building with the guilds and everything else that you've seen done even before the games already. So if you're trying to do to leverage these new aspects, that's probably a more interesting approach for me. But it's clear that when there is numbers, people will come and follow, and there is going to be a lot of experimentation, right? So this is pretty early for seeing which patterns are really working. You can probably see in 2-3 years from now, once we're going to start to do all the spreadsheeting and data, and, you know, there's a lot of that already. But for now, it's just like you don't have enough interpolation points to get really complete picture of what the things are. But, you know, you have some hunch based on the previous experience and patterns that you've seen in the past. We're trying to see them now. Some are there, some are just completely uncharted territory. So, and that's the exciting part, right? So,
I would say I am a little bit surprised at how many people have gotten in, right? Like, there's a smattering of really large companies like Ubisoft. And then there's also people outside of the gaming industry, right? Who are you know, trying to make games that maybe have more of a, I don't know, like finance or crypto style background. I think that to look back at mobile and the Facebook era and stuff, like, I feel like things should have moved faster than like having to go through the Mafia Wars, you know, Clash of Clans, Heroes Charge cycle, right? To me, like, can we just skip past that and kind of figure out what's next? And that's why I kind of think that, like, okay, that's why we're jumping immediately to this MMO state, where I think, you know, we've already made these types of games before. Do we have to, like, send ourselves back to making, I don't know, like hero battler things? And then I think there's also a lot of thinking that has to be done on how to make the game sustainable, right? Like, what's the long-term solution? You know, for certain things that are, I think, low risk, like, oh, I just want to turn my cosmetics into NFTs, then okay, that's fine. I have no problem with that. I don't really consider that quite an ecosystem yet either, you know. But yeah, I think the, like, whoever figures that out first, and like how to make a truly sustainable game that involves blockchain and stuff like that, then that's gonna be the toughest thing for everyone to figure out.
It, on one side, I think there's so many, as you said, Vincenzo, so many of these examples of games, and now we'll sort of add some NFTs to it. There's so many examples, you kind of think one of those has to work. I mean, it may conceptually seem like it shouldn't, but you just kind of think maybe one of them somehow will just sort of work. But I guess there is that sort of gap where, you know, you guys are obviously 2 years ahead of the competition now because you started in 2020 to build a game from scratch. It's just hard now. To build a game from scratch, it's not going to come out half decent one till 2024, and that seems like, you know, a long time for people to wait. So you've got this sort of weird sort of compressed time where people are just having to do something, feel like they have to do something. So the, you know, we're kind of seeing all these slightly strange games.
Yeah, I still think there's, you know, it's like, sure, the game can be far ahead. I think you can actually probably make some sort of very, very simple game which proves out the point of like how, like, lays the blueprint for how it's going to work in the future, right? Like, to me, the back in 2017 when I did Crypto Assault, the fallacy was like, oh, I'm going to make an RPG and I'm going to make this sword. It's going to have a 1% drop rate and that sword is going to be super valuable. But that doesn't hold any water for me because, like, you know, eventually that sword is going to be plentiful and there was no, like, kind of, you know, like currency being sunk into the system to make that 1% drop rate actually valuable. I mean, maybe the first few will be, but at some point it's going to fall off very, very quickly. So I think, like, figuring that puzzle is going to be, like, the most important thing. And maybe it doesn't work with every single genre of games, you know? Like, does that really work with, like, a match-based, like, esports, you know, Street Fighter, Fortnite type of thing? I don't really know. Is there enough economy there or does it? So that, I think, is, like, it doesn't matter who's ahead or who's behind or whatever. It's, like, figuring out that, like, kind of design portion is going to be what's going to make the real success.
Cool. Good. Well, we will leave that point hanging for people to think about. I think it's very much the working out the great game economy design and great blockchain game economy design are sort of two things that we haven't seen an awful lot of at the moment, but I'm sure experienced people will over time as these products launch sort of work it out, and there'll be, you know, there'll be some good concepts and then they'll be made better along the way as people are playing them and money's being spent. So great. Thank you very much, Vincenzo. And thank you very much, Dan, for your time.
Thanks very much for having us, John.
Good. And we keep our eye on what is happening to the game as it goes through its various stages. I shall put the links in the notes below if you want to find out more about what's going on there and sign up. Obviously, Discord is the best place to go, I guess. But thanks for listening to the podcast, watching the podcast, however you consume it. Remember, every week we're talking to the people who are making this, building out this new way of playing games, blockchain gaming, which certainly I think is going to be taking over the world. We will see if it happens over the next years. But thanks for watching. Come back next time.